There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the video game world and industry from the past couple of weeks. My name is Patrick Beja, and today we are going to be talking about loot boxes yet again. I know we're getting tired of it, but there are some important updates that have happened in the past couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about sales and the games we've snatched during those sales and maybe the games we've played recently. We're also going to be talking about the Resetera forum and the exodus from the other forum that may or may not be named. All of this I'm really glad we can do because we have someone absolutely perfect to discuss all of these topics in the person of Daniel Ahmad, Juge EX, or also very difficult to pronounce stuff. Between the forum name and your own nickname, you like stuff that no one knows how to pronounce, Daniel.
I do. Probably because it's a Chinese name.
Mm-hmm.
So people always pronounce it wrong. But
talking about China, I do want to ask you about PUBG going to China via who is it? Tencent, I think. No,
yeah,
not Tencent.
That's interesting. Yeah. Oh, it is Tencent.
And they're gonna have to align with socialist core values, which is gonna be also kind of what? Yeah. And Hellblade breaking even, a very interesting project of AAA title with a AA team. I think that's a little bit disingenuous of a description. It's the one the team sort of gave, but we'll talk about that as well. But first of all, thank you for being on, Daniel. You are an analyst and a provider of fine dad jokes on Twitter, but mostly where you get your job is analyst for the video game industry, right?
Yeah, that'd be good. And thanks for having me on, Patrick. It's always great to be on this podcast. I think, this is the third time?
Yeah, third or fourth, third time. Something like that.
Yeah, one of them. And it's always fun just to discuss the games with you, games industry stuff.
And I couldn't dream of anyone better to discuss all of this with than you, so let's jump into it. The loot boxes scandal is kind of the gift that never stops giving. Of course, everything came about mainly through the Battlefront 2 issue, where gamers revolted because it was the most egregious example of loot boxes that we've seen in the past few weeks and months, although the sort of issue had been boiling over for few months in the game industry, but now it's definitely gone beyond the game, the players and the game industry itself. Some governments are getting involved. We've had actually an issue reaching the Destiny 2 XP advancement system, which is going to be changed by Bungie because basically they were scaling XP to give you a little bit more when you were doing activities that wouldn't give you a lot of XP per hour, which was fine, like things like raid and stuff like that. But also scaling it down if you were doing activities that would yield a lot of XP per hour, things like public events and stuff like that. And people realized, it's not like Bungie told people, it's just that people realized that their XP bar wasn't advancing a lot. And so that sort of came to light, and it was definitely a deception. And the problem is that XP is used to give you the equivalent to loot boxes, the bright engrams that give you the rewards from loot boxes. So it can be seen, and it probably is, to limit the amount of bright engrams that players are going to get by playing the game. And Bungie very quickly acknowledged it and was like, all right, we're going to change it. Sorry, it's not working out. But it's kind of iffy to begin with. I still have a lot of love for Destiny 2. I think the loot boxes are not a problem there, as they are not in Shadow of War. Before we get into it, how much do you think the rest of the gaming industry is looking at EA now and thinking, man, we had a good thing going. Like, it was fine. It was a little bit like shady, but no one was complaining about it too much. Why did you have to go and ruin it by making a crappy version of it, EA? Why? Like, do you think they got calls from like Kotick and the Gimo brothers? Like, how do you think it went?
I think, you know, there is obviously going to be a bit of that. You know, what EA has, or at least what this kind of controversy has brought about, is a lot more awareness for, I guess, loot boxes and add-on content and microtransactions in general, and sort of how games are being designed today. And the simple fact is that they are being designed to be service games and to kind of drive engagement and spend post-launch. So it's no longer about the, you know, $60 game anymore. It's about the $60 game plus whatever engagement and spend the publisher can get out of a player. And so I think, you know, that kind of mantra in terms of games isn't going to change as much. I think we're still going to get service games. We're still going to get games like that, you know, with or without loot boxes or microtransactions or whatever. I think the implementation of them is what's going to be looked at or perhaps changed or played around with in the future. It's clear that EA went over a line when they tied loot boxes to the progression of your character in the game, whereas something like Overwatch, which is purely cosmetic and it doesn't really affect gameplay that much, isn't as intrusive and it isn't as, I guess, predatory, if you want to use that language. And so, you know, those types of games and services are still doing well. They're still generating revenue and, you know, they have millions of players that play them. And so I don't think there's going to be too much of a pushback on those types of games. But, you know, if we start seeing more publishers go down the EA route, you will start to see more pushback there. And so I think it's a case of publishers now, you know, looking at that controversy, learning from it, and understanding the best way to implement this sort of post-launch monetization.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I've expressed this sentiment in the past in the show. I'm not a big fan of loot boxes per se. Like, if they weren't there, I wouldn't, you know, mourn their losses. But I do think they can be implemented in a quote unquote, I don't want to say responsible, but beneficial way in a game like Overwatch, it's one example, or free-to-play games where it can enable free-to-play PC games. I think mobile is a lot more slimy, and I think a lot of gamers are worried that the mobile version of loot boxes will insinuate itself into the core gaming world of PCs and consoles. But I think it can work, and we have a few examples of those in the core gaming world. And again, I think Overwatch is the best one because even people who don't buy loot boxes do get the benefits of continued development, new heroes, new maps, all of those. Yeah, certainly the case of Battlefront 2 was kind of the one where everyone agreed, no, that's not the way to do it. Not to defend them, but they didn't have any chance, any opportunity to implement cosmetic improvements or changes because the IP is tightly controlled by Disney and they can't make like the pink stormtrooper or Darth Maul with pigtails, or so that wasn't an option, but still. Although I would have liked to see Darth Maul with pigtails. So that's my thought on loot boxes. It can be well done, but the government involvement is, I think a lot of people are hoping that they're going to ban loot boxes. That doesn't seem like that's what's going to happen. Certainly, there are a lot of governments weighing in with some proposed legislations. Mostly, it's gaming or gambling commissions looking at this and saying, we have to study it. There's an inquiry happening. But the preliminary thought is, we should probably work with the industry to put in boundaries and mostly warning labels or stuff like that, like treating cosmetics differently than gameplay impacting loot boxes, I don't think it's going to be banned outright, right? I mean, that's not where the governments are looking going, right?
Anyone that's expecting, you know, loot boxes in general just to be banned outright is probably going to be disappointed, because that's not what's going to happen. Neither is it what these regulators or gambling commissions are looking into right now. At this point, there isn't anything that's suggesting regulations will be implemented. At the moment, it's all kind of, you know, investigative stuff. So right. They're looking into, you know, is loot boxes in games going to be considered gambling? How does that affect console games versus, say, mobile games? How can that be communicated to the customer? You know, is it even gambling in the first place? There's all these questions that are being asked, and there isn't anything concrete about it. And even if there was something concrete, there's still a lot of process. There's a long process they'd have to follow in order to get that implemented. Because right now, it's a case of just trying to understand, you know, where loot boxes fit in. You know, Peggy and the ESRB, for example, have said that this isn't gambling as such, but that doesn't mean that there can't be other regulation in place, such as, publicly disclosing the drop rates or adding in a label on the packaging of the box, which would, you know, say this game has gambling mechanics or loot boxes or whatever it is. So, yeah, if anyone is expecting it to be banned, not going to happen. But that's not to say that, you know, these investigations won't lead anywhere, but don't expect it to be something that's, over the top and outright banning or anything.
Let's play a what if situation. Let's imagine that governments get super heavy-handed and they do end up banning entirely loot box-like mechanics. I think it wouldn't be the end of the world for the industry. I think it's very true that games have budgets that have exploded over the past, you know, few decades. It's very true as well that games prices have not increased for 30 years. I think I made a calculation in France, and the prices were 70 euros in francs back then, 30 years ago. And if you take the inflation into account alone, you get to 100 euros for the equivalent of 70 euros, you know, 30 years ago. So definitely that is true. It's also true that the market is much bigger. You have a lot more buyers for your product, so you can make up your money there. But whatever the case, games are more expensive to make, and the even beyond that, the loot box mechanics are just additional revenue that is always going to be there somehow. But let's say they were banned. I'm pretty sure we'd see stuff going okay for the games industry. I mean, you could have microtransactions that don't involve randomness. I think that's one of the things people are calling for. You could just sell skins or maybe heroes, even things that do affect gameplay. But the randomness is what rubs some people the wrong way. Of course, randomness allows you to sell stuff if you're a developer and a publisher more expensively, effectively, than if you were selling it outright, because people need to buy more to get the thing to get a chance to get it. And also, I think it's very clear that there would be, it's a nightmare for loopholes if they were banned, because you can sell it as, and I think we've seen this in some countries, like you buy a thing and as an added bonus for the thing. So it's not a loot box, you buy the thing, but you get a random added bonus on top of it, which is in effect a loot box. So you would have to ban those as well. I mean, it's a quagmire. It feels like a Pandora's box. but developers wouldn't suffer immensely with them if we banned the loot boxes.
Well, I think it's an interesting question, but at the end of the day, loot boxes, let's say hypothetically they were banned, it doesn't mean that they would that publishers would stop looking at post-launch monetization methods. you know, for example, okay, so one thing I can bring up is what's happening in China right now. And so China's actually been quite at the forefront when it comes to regulating games and the games industry in general. So a lot of people don't know that, but, you know, they've implemented laws about loot boxes back in 2009, you know, when they were running rampant in games. And a lot of that is because of the paternal kind of government that China has and then wanting to protect, you know, the youth and consumers and the people in general when it comes to that sort of stuff. And so very recently in May of this year, they introduced some more regulations, which was effectively saying that, you know, you can't sell loot boxes with real money or kind of virtual currency in a sense, and that you'd also need to disclose the drop rates for loot boxes and also ensure that those drop rates are public and that the results of the loot box distribution is public, and also keep those results on the website for 90 days or something. So, and in addition to that, make sure that you can get the items from loot boxes in game without having to buy the loot box itself. So the reason that was introduced was because, you know, China was aware that the government there was aware that this could be seen as gambling, and so they introduced those regulations and policies so that it wasn't classed as gambling anymore, but still allow publishers to implement it in a certain way that would make it not gambling. So the way that publishers do it now is that you can buy it with in-game currency, and the loophole there is that you can use real-world money to buy virtual currency, which you can then use an in-game currency. So you're still buying it with real money, but there's three extra steps you go through. Mm. It's similar to what Assassin's Creed Origins did. And then another loophole that people found is that, as you said, you can bundle loot boxes with extra items or whatever. And then that's what Blizzard has done in China. And that's how they've got around those regulations effectively. There's nothing illegal about it yet. But obviously, if China's government decides that, no, that's not acceptable, then yeah, they can clamp down on it.
But go ahead.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, if that was the case, that'd probably be the best implementation of it, where it's regulated in the sense that they have to disclose the drop rates and all that stuff. I don't think we're going to see an outright ban on these. Especially, it's because that would be a huge, complicated mess that would apply to every single game and industry, and it wouldn't work out that well.
And it's also, it begs the question of other quote-unquote loot boxes like Panini stickers, you know, collections, and games like Magic the Gathering. I had discussions with people on Twitter where I was genuinely asking, like, Magic the Gathering is loot boxes. Like, those games we've grown up with, those Panini stickers, the Yu-Gi-Oh! and Pokemon trading card games, they are loot boxes as well. And I don't think they've ruined the you know, youth, as it's often you know, put forth as an argument, like, oh, it's predatory for kids. Yeah, I can see that. I can even agree to an extent, but it's to me, it doesn't feel like gambling, as because you can't make money out of it. Now, the definition of gambling is kind of fluid, so I can see how it could be considered gambling. But so the bottom line for me is, I really don't think it's gambling, but I do agree it is something. I don't know what, but it is something. And it's. I can see how it would require extra steps in regulation. But I think ultimately a solution that seems reasonable would be to have labels, warning labels on the games, saying this game has random-based post-purchase transactions. Basically, this game has loot boxes. Sure. Having the percentages more obviously displayed, I think, could be a good thing. Could be informing the consumers a little bit more. That could be beneficial. And potentially not certain yet, but maybe some age restrictions, especially on loot boxes that include gameplay elements. If it's all cosmetic, I think it's more acceptable. But if it's gameplay elements, maybe restrict to, I don't know, 13, 16 years old, something like that. And I think that seems like a reasonable compromise for everyone. A lot of people on Twitter were agreeing with a poll I made. Not everyone. There were still some people who were saying, just ban it completely. But those three things, warning labels, percentages, although percentages, you know, statistically, we basically know them if you look for them. But still, it's good to surface them. So warning labels, percentages, and maybe age restriction for some of the things seems like it would be a good compromise. What do you think? Do you have another idea to throw in there if we were talking about what we would like to see happen in that field?
Yeah, I mean, going back to your point about, you know, trading cards, blind bags, and all that sort of stuff, it is very similar in the sense that if you look at some of the top-selling products this holiday, you've got the Hatchimals collectible stuff, which is effectively, you know, blind bags or whatever, and you get random Hatchimals, and then you've got to collect them all. So it's a very similar sort of thing when it comes to the psychology behind it, and that's why, you know, across loads of industries, you'll see that sort of stuff. And yeah, a lot of it is targeted at kids, whether it's Star Wars Battlefront 2, or whether it's these kind of, you know, Hatchimals or Pokemon trading cards or whatever it is. You know, it is there, and that's just what it is. And so, you know, if
I mean, it is there, and I mean, we grew up with those as well, and I think the dramatic nature of all of this is being overemphasized a little bit, like, oh, it's predatory and it's gambling for kids. It feels like, you know, it's cigarettes and booze being forced into your kids, you know, six-year-olds' courtyards. I think there's a little bit of over-exaggeration there. We grew up with all of those, and I think we grew up okay. We're not, you know, addicted to Pokemon trading cards. So
sure,
there's a little bit of measure that needs to be inserted into that conversation, it feels.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see on the backs of those packs as well that they have, you know, guidelines and warnings and kind of the drop rates and stuff for that.
Right.
So those, some of those are regulated and some of those already do. And, you know, at the end of the day, the fact that you can actually sell those cards if you want, I mean, it does make it closer to gambling. As you say, the definition of gambling is fluid. But you know, in a sense, it is a very similar thing, and the only difference here is this is digital and that's physical. So that's the major difference. And I think that, you know, there's going to be a lot of conversation around it in terms of, you know, classifying it and what would be the best appropriate way to deal with those sort of transactions. I think at the very minimum, you're going to get the regulators say stuff like, okay, just implement parental controls, so that, you know, children can't access it. And at the maximum, you're going to get, okay, well, it's going to have warning labels and drop rates disclosed and all that stuff. So, you know, you saw a very similar thing on mobile games. It wasn't loot boxes per se. It was more kind of just general add-on content and in-game app purchases, so in-app purchases. And so that was sold by just saying, okay, we'll put parental controls on it and put warnings that, you know, this includes in-app purchases and all that stuff. So I think that's what you're going to get out of this instead of the whole loot boxes being banned. And I think that people that do want loot boxes being banned have to sort of reconsider it a bit, because this sort of stuff exists across a lot of entertainment sectors, you know, and kind of kids' toys and digital games and whatever. And so it's something that's already there and that is regulated, and expecting to be banned, probably not going to happen. Expecting it to be regulated, sure, that's a reasonable take on it. And it's something that, you know, I push for myself. And, you know, at the end of the day, with the free market that we have, you know, if there's a game like Battlefront 2 where you don't like it, or you're not a fan of the monetization, yeah, first of all, don't buy it. Second of all, make your voice heard to the developer or the publisher, you know, in a calm manner, write into them by email or something and say, look, these are the reasons I'm not buying it, or I'm not supporting your game. If you make these changes, then yeah, I'll buy it. And obviously, you know, you can inform others as well. There's no need to shame people if they're going to buy the game anyway. That's their choice. You know, I have friends who will buy it, some friends that won't buy it. It's entirely up to them, because at the end of the day, it's an entertainment product. It's not a
Yeah, I think the voices of some people who enjoy this game, even as it is being drowned out by a few very angry voices. And this actually, what you're saying, is giving me an opportunity to push back on the very, very angry voices we've heard in this debate. And I understand the value of anger. I think sometimes it is needed. And maybe in the case of Battlefront 2, maybe some outrage was necessary. Maybe it's possible, but I do think that in some cases, gamers especially, but people in general, on YouTube, you have a few people that are almost specializing in anger, you know, and they're taking the voice of, hey, I'm the common person voicing your outrage against the man, you know, and I represent the man is out to screw you and F them because this and that. And it feels to me extremely, well, maybe not hypercritical, maybe for some of them, they're genuine, but that the fact that, you know, I make this analogy, and I've talked about this in a few episodes, in a few different shows already, anger sells in the same way that sex sells, you know? And that anger that is being peddled, I've taken to calling them like anger mongers because I think it fits. They're selling you anger because anger makes you more likely to follow them and like them and be angry. And like, it is their commerce. This is what they do. They sell anger. And I think it's very important to be aware of this. I think anger is ultimately a very negative way of approaching these issues because it clouds your judgment. It makes you not able to see what the problems are. And ultimately, how to fix them in a way that is durable and reliable. So I just wanted to take the opportunity to talk about this. This anger sells issue is very real, and especially in the video game industry. And those people that make their living out of peddling anger, I think it's not a healthy thing. And when there are things that need to be said, of course, we have to say them. And I think in the case of Battlefront 2, it was said, absolutely, and it needed to be said. And in the whole loot box debate, probably it needed to be discussed as well, but it was. And this idea that the game industry is circling down the toilet and that developers are there to screw you over and that, you know, it's the man against you. It's like, it is so much, again, people selling anger. Because the game industry is incredibly diverse in the sense that there are so many things existing right now. Like, you know, you have AAA games, of course, but you have small indies, you have small developers that create games that are in the middle between the two, and a whole range. And in all of those, we have so many great products. I mean, we've been spending the last 2 years telling everyone, oh my God, there have never been so many great games in the world. So it is, the industry is working better than it ever has. I mean, sure, there are issues that we need to address. Loot boxes is one of them. Maybe the way some of the developers are being pushed and the crunch time. And there are issues. I'm not saying there aren't. But if the argument is the industry is rotten, I think this is anger peddling, anger mongering. The industry or the games have never been better in any way you want to look at them. So anyway, that was my little, rant for the day.
No, I mean, I do agree with you. And I think obviously that there's some people out there who do a really great job on YouTube or whatever platform.
Yeah, of course. I didn't mean consumers to imply that I hate YouTubers. That's not the case. Yeah.
But I do agree that there are some that, you know, who will put anger before facts. And I think what that does lead to is sometimes you'll get, you know, some people who will send death threats and get overly angry and kind of not see the full picture. And I think that one thing that people need to do is, first of all, not trust everything or not blindly believe everything that someone tells you straight away, especially when they're the person that's, you know, screaming the loudest or whatever. You know, take some time to look at the facts, do some research yourself. I know that's not something that everyone can do, but, you know, getting a wide variety of opinions before just kind of you know, letting confirmation bias take over.
I would say better. Get sources you trust first and learn to trust them. And screaming the most loud is not a criterion for getting trust, right? I think that's important. But getting the people that you trust is something that is key. But yeah, sorry, keep going.
Sure. I've seen a few YouTube videos where, you know, they have a good point, but the evidence that they use or the facts that they present in general are incorrect. And so,
yeah,
you know, you have to kind of look at that and actually, because don't get me wrong, some of these YouTube videos actually have a good overall point. Like they actually want to get across this reason, but the way they get to that point is incorrect, and it leads to a lot of misinformation, and then that's used against, you know, developers or publishers or whatever, right, in an incorrect way. I mean, one thing that I want to say just quickly is that, you know, the whole reason we're having this debate is purely because of the switch we've seen in the games industry over the past decade, in that a lot of publishers these days are moving towards service games instead of kind of fire and forget games. So what that means is, you know, you go back 10 years ago, you have a game like Uncharted 1, for example, where it's a single-player game, 10 hours, $60, that's it. Now you have games like Destiny 2 or Grand Theft Auto 5, where the whole experience is more online-based, and it's encouraging you to engage over a long period of time. And there are a few reasons for that. So one of the bigger ones is that, I guess, you know, the consumer base on consoles is a lot more engaged this generation than last generation. It's also a smaller user base, just purely because we had stuff like Wii last generation and Nintendo DS and all that, you know, PSP stuff. Whereas this generation, you've got, you know, a couple of core consoles that are selling well. And because of that, in particular, there's a push to kind of generate more revenue from each individual player. And at the end of the day, average revenue per user is actually increasing a huge amount, because people are buying more games, first of all. People are willing to spend more in games, you know, for expansion packs or microtransactions or download content or loot boxes or whatever. And so publishers are, you know, implementing more of that because they know that people are going to buy it. And the second reason as well is because, in general, you know, you have seen the publishers, the top 10 publishers at least. And bear in mind, when I say all this stuff, I am talking about AAA-style publishers.
Right.
So the top 8 publishers account for about 80% of the total package software sales in the US, just to give you a random quote. So these guys make up, you know, the huge amount of sales and huge amount of the market, just those 8 publishers alone. You know, that's stuff like Activision, Take-Two, Ubisoft, etc., EA. And so what they want to do is hold on to that market share. And so they want to create games that are going to sell in big numbers and into kind of, you know, as many people as possible and as profitable as possible. And so they are creating games. They're creating less games every year in order to do that. One, because in general, game development is getting more, you know, if you want to create games at that high level, you need more resources, more time, more money. That's why games take, you know, 3-4 years to develop and these days compared to the standard 1 year or 2 years before.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people mention that we don't see those kind of crappy, half-assed games that we saw a few years ago. And that corresponds, that correlates, I guess, with the increase in quality of games that we've seen over the past two years. And you're right, developers develop a lot less games with roughly a much higher budget per game. So they spend a lot more time, talent, and energy on each one.
It's because those smaller games don't sell as much. Again, when you command 80% of the market, the other 20% doesn't really, you don't really want to compete there because that's everyone else. And so, you know, releasing smaller games, yes, you'll see, you know, Ubisoft release stuff like Grow Up, and you'll see EA release stuff like A Way Out and all that stuff. But, you know, those games don't generate the same sort of return that a big AAA, you know, Battlefield or The Division or whatever would generate. And so the publishers are putting money into development. They're putting money into marketing because at the end of the day, they want to create the best product out there that's above the competition. They want to market it to everyone that they can. And that's why you have Overwatch, which has 35 million players, whereas a smaller game, which tries to be Overwatch, can't really compete on that level. And so, you know, that's what they're trying to do, and that's what they're doing it. And the simple fact is that budgets have increased. That's a fact. The overall spend may not have for some publishers, but when you look at EA, who are publishing 50 games in 2010, now they're publishing 6 or 7 games every year in 2017. You know, the actual amount they're spending per game is a huge amount. And, you know, that's why a game that's a service game is more likely to be greenlit, because you can spend $80 million on a single-player game and then have to sell you know, a certain amount of copies to make your money back. Or you could spend $80 million on a service game, sell the same amount of copies, but also have a post-launch monetization model, which keeps players engaged and keeps them spending over the lifetime of a cycle. That's why Grand Theft Auto V, for example, has been so profitable, not just in full-game sales, but in actual, you know, post-launch content as well,
right,
you know, through the shark class that they have. And that's also why games like Rainbow Six Siege continue to sell really well every month. That's why it's selling so much. Whereas a game like, you know, for example, Wolfenstein or, you know, a single-player game will have a limit on how much it can sell, purely because people aren't engaged after that 5, 6, 7, 8-hour game, and they're not going to recommend it to their friends to come and play with them online or whatever.
Right, constantly, so, months after the release.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why those games, you know, are actually underperforming for Bethesda. That's why Agents of Mayhem didn't do that well. That's why a lot of single-player games haven't done that well. And, I mean, one thing I'll say finally is that a lot of people say to me, okay, but what about games like, you know, Sony first party, Nintendo first party? What about Nier Automata and all that sort of stuff? And yeah, you're right, those games do exist. And the reason for their single-player games existing, when Nintendo and Sony, for example, is one, they have a completely different strategy to third-party. They don't really want to compete with third-party AAA. They want to get people on their console, so they make games for a wider audience. Secondly, those games in general, the margins on them are a lot higher for Sony and Nintendo, because Nintendo and Sony will charge Activision, you know, $10 to publish each game, you know, each individual game on their system, whereas Sony and Nintendo don't pay that cost. So they actually end up earning a lot more from their games. If for example, they sell 8 million units, and that would give them more money than if Activision sold 8 million units. So that's the logic behind it. And with Nier Automata and all that sort of stuff, those are more AAA games. Sorry, those are more AA games, more mid-tier games. You've also got this whole indie audience as well. So yeah, as you said earlier, there is this kind of bigger market outside of AAA that is still making single player, is still you know, focusing on other type of genres and elements and all that sort of stuff. And so you'll find that, yeah, they will implement service elements, but there's still games that I think a lot of people will find were around 10 years ago or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think ultimately, when I look at the offerings that we have in the market right now, for, you know, the reasons that you explained very well, we still have a very wide breadth of different types of games, because for all of the issues that may exist with the single player games, we have them, right? Yes, they are first party because, you know, better returns, but they're still there, and we have very compelling offerings for the single player games. And the other thing I want to mention is that some people might think, wow, it's terrible that the business model is influencing the game design. And this is, I think, very naive, because for the entire history of the gaming industry, that's been the case. I mean, even its inception, like arcades, where the design was literally making sure the player would die every 5 minutes so that they would put another coin in. And so obviously it's always tied to that, and hopefully the game designers make the best of it. But I'm also reminded of the outrage about DLC a few years back when people were saying, sure. Oh, you're cutting the game in different pieces and then selling back to us. And that was a problem initially, but then the balance was found. And now, as I often say, DLC is like you, as long as you get a fully complete, full-fledged basic game, then the DLC is more content for those who want it. And if you don't want it, you don't have to buy it. And I think that works really well for people who really like a game. And to conclude this, I do want to mention about the outrage and anger that it robbed us of a rethinking of the model around DRM with the Xbox One when it was first announced. There were some bad things in there. But there were also some good things, like the fact that you could resell a game that you purchased digitally. You could resell it, you could lend it, you could do stuff with it. And the outrage was so blind and strong that it got all shut down, I think with reason, because Microsoft definitely, you know, jumbled that message and did a mess of it. Legendary mess, actually. But the result is now we have digital games that we purchase and can do nothing with. And that is not a great thing for consumers. So the whole point is, when someone promotes anger, it's kind of like, you know, the two magic things, like this is to protect the children and this is terrorism. This is to fight terrorism. Whenever you hear those two things, you should take a second, take a step back, and really think an extra minute about what you're being told to make sure it's actually the case. And I think when the message is being conveyed with a lot of anger, you should have the same reaction. Doesn't mean it's wrong. Doesn't mean the underlying conclusion is wrong. But it warrants that extra minute, that little bit of measure, couple of steps back. All right, what am I being told here? So anyway.
Yeah,
that's the
conclusion
for me.
and with Microsoft, I think, you know, that's a perfect example of how businesses are run, in terms of they could very easily now just have it so you can sell your digital games, but they haven't implemented that at all. And it's because as a business, they want to find, you know what's going to work with them, what's not going to work with them. Obviously, they will try and be as pro-consumer as possible, because they want sales at the end of the day.
Yeah, within but, the yeah, as long as it yeah. serves their
as long
bottom
as it serves
line,
their,
then yeah,
their bottom line, then yeah, they'll do whatever. So you know, there's
because by the way, because of competition, because if they aren't
yeah, sure.
as pro consumer as they can, then someone else might be, and then that's how it works. But yeah,
yeah. So I mean, that's been the case with, you know, game designers, you know, for decades now, and so. Thinking that one company is doing something better is good, but at the end of the day, they're still looking out for the bottom line, and that's how all businesses work. That's just a simple fact. I hate to be cynical, but that's how it is. And so, you know, there are a few positives to the way that games are being made today. Yes, obviously, a lot of it is about design, about engagement and spend, but the fact is that, you know, service games are starting to solve some of the issues with you know, how games are distributed, in the sense that, you know, a lot of the content now that comes out is for free. So, for example, with Star Wars Battlefront 2, all the content is for free. Grand Theft Auto 5, all the content is for free. And it's monetized through, you know, microtransactions on loot boxes or whatever. And so that solves the issue with, you know, season passes, for example, where only people who pay $5, $10, whatever, would get access to the extra maps or the extra content or whatever comes out. And at the same time, that benefits developers and publishers, because it means that people aren't fired at the end of shipping a product, or that they aren't moved to different, you know, they aren't moved around or reshuffled or fired or whatever. And the fact that they can continue working on that game and putting out content and have that funded by, you know, gamers or whatever.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of considerations. Those are definitely positive aspects of those post, you know, release content and transactions, which if the angry mobs had had their say a few years ago, then they wouldn't happen today, which some people are going to say, oh, why don't you do it like this other game that sells, and then that's it. And but it's not, you know, not every game has to be exactly the same. I think there are many great games that work that way. There are some other games that work a different way. And so ultimately, in all of this, this super complicated mess of different parameters and demands and requirements and needs, that's why I take the slighter, you know, longer view, which is how are games today? And again, I don't think you can have it both ways. Everyone has been saying for the past 2 years, we've never had as many good games, period. Like indies, double A, triple A, all, like, it's all amazing how the industry is behaving right now from the output point of view. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say all of these amazing games are coming nowadays and we have like embarrassment of choices of riches for game of the year this year, and at the same time saying, oh, it's all going to shit, the industry is crap. You know, you just can't have it both ways. So anyway, and some people are going to say, oh, but I'm looking down the line like 2-3 years. Yeah, sure, of course, that's a cop-out, I think, so, because the complaints have been happening for a while. Anyway, we're being vigilant. I think it's important, but do it with actual thought and measure and facts, and not with mob mentality and anger.
Yeah, and one final point I just want to bring up really quickly, sure, is that, you know, at the end of the day, there is that supply-demand, you know, kind of factor in play. And at the end of the day, if companies are putting out products and people are buying them, you know, there's not a huge amount that people can do other than vote with their wallets and obviously, you know, tell the developers they're not going to support certain business practices or whatever. But from the way that, you know, I'm looking at the industry and from the data that I can see and from speaking to others, there isn't anything to suggest that there's been an impact across other companies in terms of their post-launch monetization methods or kind of revenue from that. You know, games like Overwatch are still doing extremely well. Games like Grand Theft Auto 5 obviously are massive, huge. Destiny's also doing, you know, relatively well. They need to fix a few things there, of course. But once they do, and once they listen to consumer feedback and kind of, you know, pivot the game as they need to, then, yeah, you know, these games are actually doing quite well, and they're profitable, they're selling well. And at the end of the day, the mass market consumer is actually, you know, fairly open to these games. And I think a lot of people actually are, but there are obviously lines where, you know, people don't want companies to cross. And I think that's good that they're being drawn now rather than later.
Yeah. There's definitely going to be, as we said in the beginning, we're coming full circle. There's going to be consequences to that whole scandal. People are going to be, companies are going to be a little bit more reticent to implement things that cross the line. If we do end up getting warning labels and stuff like that, that's going to have a deterring effect as well, which is probably a good thing. So ultimately, things are going the way they should. And the industry is being corrected and we're finding balance. And I don't think we need mob mentality to achieve that. Maybe we do, but I really don't think so. Because mob mentality didn't do anything against, you know, Shadow of War and Destiny, because those games, if you look at them, as I did when I played dozens or hundreds of hours, are fine. And the mob mentality against those was not warranted. So I don't think that the mob mentality was needed with Battlefront 2. What was needed is, you know, the facts to be laid out properly and the proper authorities to take a look at it. And that's what was needed, not the kind of, you know... Anyway, we spent too much time on this. Let's talk about sales. Everything must go. Sales, sales, sales. It's Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And oh my God, in a year with so many amazing games coming out, as I've said many times, the sales are incredible. Like, specifically for Steam, I've taken, like, I don't usually, well, that's not true. I do buy stuff from Steam, but during the sales, but this time I went crazy. Like, all of my games on my wish list were available. So I bought Wolfenstein, Hob, Vanquish, actually, old game I wanted to try, Nier Automata, that I do want to try because everyone's saying it's amazing, Hellblade, and Phantasy Strike. And I have so many games to play. I went and finished Mario, the last level, which was super hard, but super fun. So much fun, that game. There's Cyber Monday sales on PlayStation with VR consoles, deals on Xbox One S's as well everywhere. So many things to buy and play. I'm curious, do you have any games you've been playing recently? I know you finished Assassin's Creed Origins. Anything you want to mention that you enjoyed, that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I mean, as you said, I finished Assassin's Creed Origins. That was a good game for me. I've been a fan of the series for a while. I think there were some good changes made to the series. And then obviously the whole kind of world building around the game was really impressive, and I quite enjoyed that. I think the weakest points were probably the story, and also some of the RPG elements may not have worked as well in terms of maybe some combat stuff or leveling up stuff. I think, you know, if they work on that, next year's game or whenever the next game is could be, you know, really good. And yeah, that was a fun game. That was my sort of, you know, I put a lot of hours into that. So that was the big game I played recently. I've now moved on to Mario Odyssey, which yes. I'm playing. And so I've got I've got to the Water Kingdom and the Lake Kingdom, or whatever it's called.
It's either Lake Kingdom or Seaside Kingdom. It's one of the two with lots of water. If it's icy water, it's icy is Lake Kingdom.
Yeah, it'd be Lake Kingdom and then Water Kingdom. And yeah, it's good. I mean, I've died about 100 times already, but apart from that, it's really fun, and I like how it introduces sort of first of all the cap mechanic, but then also you know, uses that across multiple different ways. And I'll be honest, I still have no idea how to get some of the stars. So I'll need to kind of, you know, work that out. But I've got all of the ones that it needs you to get, you know, to move on to each kingdom. But there's still some that I see up in really high places, and like, how do you get there? But I guess that'll be the fun of it.
It's really well done in the sense that it is never punishing. You know, it allows you to go forward and to explore, and it gives you freedom, and all it communicates is joy. Like when you capture a new enemy, it's just fun to use, and it never frustrates you. And I did mention the last level, the hidden one, is mind-bogglingly difficult when you first encounter it. It's like, this is so difficult, it's dumb, and I'm never going to be able to do it. But you keep banging your head against it. And the really interesting thing is that after a few dozen minutes, maybe a couple of hours, most of it becomes trivial. I mean, it's still difficult, and maybe it's more than a couple of hours, but once you have learned how to deal with it, it's just trivial. And that's the case because the game has taught you all of those mechanics for the entire game, and it has amazing game design that teaches you how to tackle the challenges it puts in front of you. But it's so much joy to actually be able to conquer that level. And some people have mentioned, you know, it's kind of like Dark Souls. And I agree to an extent, but Dark Souls does this through frustration, I think. Dark Souls, or, you know, all of those games do this through making you sad. And Mario does this through making you happy. And I think that is an incredible achievement on Nintendo's side. So I played that as well. As I mentioned, I bought Phantasy Strike and Hob. I do want to talk about Wolfenstein, but first, Phantasy Strike, super fun, super simple fighting game. And some people might have heard about Rising Thunder, which was a game that was endeavoring to make fighting games understandable and simple enough that anyone could go and play them. I think ultimately Phantasy Strike failed. Ultimately Rising Thunder failed, but Phantasy Strike is really fun. It does away with so much of the fat of fighting games and leaves only the main meat of goodness of fighting games. And it's still in early access, so I wouldn't recommend anyone go buy it now. But I think it has a really interesting, I don't know how successful it's going to be, but it's a super interesting approach to fighting games. And as a fighting game fan, I think it could be a really fun game for people who are curious about the genre and who just want to have fun with friends. I don't know how deep it is yet. I have to still look into it a little bit more. But I was very, very surprised. Phantasy Strike, apart from having the worst name in the world, possibly, I think it's a terrible name, it's some elements of the design of this game are insanely clever. Like, super, super clever. All of the moves you make are one button in one direction, basically. And that's it. And still, it retains enough depth that is it is interesting, at least for a few hours. And so things like your health bar is not an obscure number in the hundreds. You have like 7 sections or 8 sections, and each hit will take off one. So, and initially, it's a little bit disorienting, but really, it works super well. So anyway, Phantasy Strike. Hob, really nice game. It's like this wonderful little gem of a Metroidvania slash Zelda type thing, lower budget. It's from Runic Entertainment, which it's so sad because the company actually had to close because I think that game came out. It was not in great shape, the company, and the game came out, and it feels like they were trying to push it, make one last push. It came out in a sea of amazing AAA games, so it was drowned. Any other year or time, I think Hob could have been a more significant success. It's so poetic, so beautiful. It's peaceful. It's just a little gem. And it's really sad that they couldn't make their endeavor work. But if I think it's worth picking up if you're done with all of the thousands of other great games that are available this year. Or if you want something for, a more quiet enjoyment. And it would be great on the Nintendo Switch, but sadly, I don't think that's going to happen because the company is not there anymore.
It's unfortunate, yeah.
Yeah. And finally, Wolfenstein 2. So I haven't finished the game. I think, maybe 5-6 hours in. I passed that moment where things happen that everyone refers. And, I mean, I finished the first one last week. I had never finished it. I was very late to the Wolfenstein party. And I will say the second one is sort of a continuation of the first one in every way, but slightly improved in every way as well. It has the same faults. The gameplay itself is fun. It's not going to blow anyone's mind. It's okay. It's fun. I've heard a lot of people saying, oh, you have to play an easy because what the hell, it's too difficult sometimes. I don't find that at all. I think the difficulty is quite well tuned. I play on the middle level of difficulty and it works really well. I have to, restart levels sometimes, but I've done the whole first game and at least until now, the second game in that level. But the gameplay is not the main part. The storytelling is, surprising for a Wolfenstein game, and it's on the level of any other narrative-focused game out there. Like, it's just as good as Uncharted, just as good as any other of those games. Pretty incredible how they managed to stay entirely true to the incredibly goofy spirit of Wolfenstein, which is basically, for those who don't know, Wolfenstein is this dude, this soldier dude, going to kill Nazis that are half robots and half mechs. Like, the last boss of the Wolfenstein 3D is Mecha Hitler. So it's just wacky and dumb. And in this game, it is the same kind of wacky, but it builds up that world super well. And it makes BJ Blazkowicz, which was an icon on your, basically a soup of pixels on your screen into a fully fledged character with emotions and relationships, and you understand the character and how he relates to everything around him, and it is such a great, an incredible achievement for that game and that company. I mean, I could not recommend that game. Yes, I could recommend a game more, but that is going to be a heavy, unless it goes to shit in the second half, but it's going to be a heavy contender for my best game of the year, because it's just perfect in everything it tries to do. It's not perfect in every way, but everything it endeavors to do, it achieves. And that feeling of having Nazi-occupied America, I don't think I've ever seen so well crafted before. I know there's The Man in the High Castle as a TV show, but I mean, it at least rivals that, and sometimes even more cynically and well written. How well it's written is out of this world. It's perfect pitch. It's never, you know, pushing it too far, maybe a little bit too far, but you know, it mixes like heart-wrenching depictions of things with humor that is saddening at the same time. It's weird and super well done. And at the same time, I will say, I do a political show as well, which is, well, a news show, which is called the Fidesz Club on the same site. And having delved into that very in a very neutral and measured manner, I have to say it is extremely satisfying to have a pop culture thing where Nazis are unquestionably bad people. And you don't have any ifs or buts or maybe or, you know, but, you know, that's the reason or having to delve into stuff. No, they're bad. You shoot, even though there are some things that show the, you know, other aspects of it too, but you shoot them in the face and they're not. It reminded me of the 80s when I grew up, you know. We realized back then that Nazis were actually bad. It seems people have forgotten. So I love this game for many, many, many reasons. I can't wait to see what happens next. And it's an incredible achievement. And Bethesda and Machine Games should be commended for it. So go buy Wolfenstein 2. Oh, actually, buy Wolfenstein 1. Very cheap right now. And then buy Wolfenstein 2 when you're done with it. It's not absolutely necessary to do the first one first, but I think it's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard some good things about the game as well. And I think, you know, we need more games like that. You know, just kind of really grip you in and have a great story. And good games, don't you?
Yeah. I do think that it is one of the better ones of that that category. It's simple enough that it doesn't embarrass itself with, like, it's not an open world where you have like collect 15 million things. Like, you do have collections of stuff, but it's not necessarily the kind of thing that you need to achieve to, like, it's not filler, or it is filler, but you don't need it. But you know, between Doom and this, it's kind of an incredible, incredible achievement for Bethesda these past few years. And can't wait to see what they're going to be doing next. All right, so let's move on. Before we move to quick news, I did want to ask you, since we have you here, a couple of months ago, there was this NeoGAF collapsing thing. It since came back up, and then Reset Era has sort of taken the how in French we say take the relay, but like the it's now one of the main hubs for industry people. It's a forum that people go to from the industry to discuss stuff. Can you tell us a little bit, because you were one of the people behind the creation of Reset Era, how do we pronounce this?
I mean, it's both, I guess. You know, it's like Ubisoft or Ubisoft.
All right, fair enough. So yeah, what happened there? What was what is it now? How's it going? All of that.
Yeah, I mean, it all happened extremely fast, to be honest. The first week is still a bit of a blur, but I guess, you know, what happened was that when Gareth went down, there were a lot of people who were considering moving away to, you know, different platforms or looking for a new forum. And so, you know, this was really kind of a community effort where we all decided just to work together on a new forum. And so, you know, we had a huge response from people who were working in tech or, you know, web design or interest in helping out and, you know, policy making or whatever, just come on board and then just, you know, work on this great forum, which was basically one of Sirium, the admin. It was his idea to kind of, you know, start working on that. And so I think a lot of people were quick to rally behind it just because everyone was kind of forced into Discords or whatever. And so there was a whole disjointed mess going on.
And we have to say, maybe for people who don't know what NeoGAF was or maybe still is, it's really a place where, is it fair to say it was the town hall for the industry? So many people from the actual industry, like developers and not just, and journalists and analysts and all of those, were coming to that forum to discuss stuff from the industry, sometimes in a slightly unnerving manner. But is it fair to say it's a town hall for the video games industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the most popular, I guess, gaming forum out there. And, you know, it's referenced quite a lot in media and kind of, and stuff like that. And there were some prominent members on there. So, yeah, I mean, that's the general gist of NeoGAF in general. I was a poster there a couple of years back, and that, you know, that was a good time. The new forum that we created was effectively something that the community wanted as a place where they could post. And, you know, what was really awesome is seeing the response from over 80 different Discord communities, you know, whether that be kind of, you know, sales communities who are interested in video game sales or kind of, you know, certain game communities or whatever. You know, they all came together to migrate over to this new forum. And so far, it's been a really great experience. And like I said, the whole, I don't know how everything came together so fast in that 1 week, but it did. And, you know, there's now 30,000 members on the forum, and it's really awesome. I think it just goes to show that, you know, a forum is more about the community and the content and the posters and not so much about an individual or a brand name or something.
Yeah. So nowadays, I think from my experience, maybe it's because I follow some of the people that went there, it seems to me that Resetera is basically the de facto new industry town hall to an extent. But it's definitely super active, and there's lots of good people there. You also have a less lenient policy, I would say. Like, it's possible to post anonymously, but you do have some safeguards in place. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people were looking for a new forum to join, and so, you know, Resetera being the place where a lot of creators went and where a lot of the community went, it meant that, you know, that attracted a lot of people to it. And so it's great to see that we've got so many people signed up and posting. And, and you know, we do want to create a place where it's, I guess, not as heavy-handed or where people will be banned for voicing, you know, random or certain opinions. We do want to make this place a welcoming place for everyone, and you know, a place where the moderation is there, but it's done in a way that's transparent and open. And you know, so some stuff that we've done, for example, is have it so that users are not given warnings before they're banned. In most cases, if they are banned, it's usually a 24-hour ban, depending on the content or the offending post. And all these messages are public, so you'll be able to see why users are banned, why they've been warned, and hopefully that helps shape the conversation so that we can get some really great content on there and some really great conversations going. And I think that, you know, looking at the forum over the past month, it's done really well in that regard. And there's a lot of people who are sharing their thoughts on things, you know, sharing various news items and just having a great general discussion. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm super happy with how it's turning out.
How do you handle anonymity? Because there was, I mean, one of the great things on NeoGAF was the leaks, right? There would be people who anonymously went and leaked stuff that maybe they weren't supposed to. And my understanding is that on Resetera, you have a little bit less of that anonymity, or maybe there are special measures for some people. How do you handle those? Can we expect to get some weird leaks there, or is that something you've foregone for making sure that people were a little bit more responsible for what they were saying?
You know, I think leaks in general is something that you can't really police across the internet. You're going to get them on Reddit. You're going to get them posted everywhere. And so they'll eventually make their way to Resetera as well, whether that's a new thread or just a post, you know, linking to a different website.
Right.
So, I mean, that's going to happen. You know, what we do have in place and what we're trying to work on is a verification program for those that do work in the industry. And so how that will work is that it'll allow people to, you know, verify their role. So if they're a journalist or a developer or whatever, they can verify through us, and they would then get a verified tag on their account. And so what that does is that gives them, you know, a bit of a voice, and it gives them more authenticity behind their posts. And so when they do post in a thread about a certain thing, you know that they're talking from a place where they have the knowledge to do so. Mm. And so that gives posters the ability to trust them a bit more, and in turn to actually learn from them, and vice versa. And so we're trying to help bridge the gap between, you know, the forum community and the games industry. And further on that, we're looking to introduce sort of a Q&A sort of product or whatever. And so similar feature, to sort of feature, yes, that's it. Sorry. And similar to what Reddit do with, you know, AMAs, is something that we're going to try and do here. And it's going to be with people in the games industry. And it'll be sort of, you know, where users can ask questions that they want answers to or that they want to learn about. And, you know, people in the industry can respond. And so that's something that we're planning to roll out pretty soon.
That's really cool. So you're looking at the forum not as a, well, that's the forum and that's it, but you're planning on adding features as time goes on? Or is it just that this one was something you thought of and you're implementing, and maybe there won't be any additional ones in the future?
Well, I think, you know, we always listen to what the community wants. And so when we were actually building this forum, we had a lot of suggestions come in as to, you know, how best to do certain things or what ideas could work in the future. And so we've been looking at them and kind of talking with people about them. And so, you know, we have a plan in place to keep adding features to the forum. One, so the community is you know, getting what they want, but two, so that other people can actually sign up and join in with those things. And so, you know, the Q&A, for example, is one of those ideas that, you know, we thought was great, the community thought was great, and so we're now starting to implement that. It's not something we're doing right this second, but in the future, you'll see that it happens.
So, yeah, that all sounds really cool, but it does lead me to a natural question, which is, this all sounds like a huge amount of work. Are you planning on eventually monetizing all of this, or like, how is it going to work? Because you have lots of people working on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing is we've got a really great team of admins and moderators who have, you know, volunteered to help and have put a lot of time and dedication into actually making this work. And so, you know, first of all, I think everyone is thankful that the community and the mods and the admins are doing a really great job on this. And in terms of monetization, we haven't really spoken about that at this point, purely because that hasn't been our main thought. Our main thought has been, you know, how do we get this forum up and running? How do we get people signing up? How do you make it so the forum doesn't crash every 5 seconds? You know, those technical questions and kind of community questions. And so the admin has, Sirium in this case, who's the main owner of the website, has decided that he's going to fund it through to the end of the year by himself. And that's really awesome of him. And, you know, if we are going to look into monetization in the future, we'll announce that at a later date, probably in the new year, because we still need to actually have the discussions around, you know, how that would work. Mm. Because, as I say, right now, our main concern is just about making the forum happen.
Right.
And I think the past month has proved that, you know, we've been able to do that.
So you're still in let's build it because we want it mode, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the entire philosophy behind this forum, is that people wanted a place where they could, you know, continue posting as they had perhaps on different forums or in different communities. And there was a huge rally of different communities who were happy to migrate here for that very reason. And so that's what we've been working towards. And I think, you know, as you can see, it's really doing well.
Yeah. Yeah. And for those listeners who might be thinking, well, this is a little bit arcane, I don't know why this is important. It's really, you know, I would mention a lot, like a huge amount. Like, there are two centers of the gaming news, the underground gaming news on the internet. It's Reddit, as always, for everything. But more importantly, for the past few years, NeoGAF was a huge element of that. And with it losing some of its importance, it looks like Reset Era is poised to maybe take up that mantle. So it definitely is a big part of the news cycle for the V-game industry. So that's something to pay attention to. So anyway, thank you for those details, Daniel. And let's move on to a few quick bits of news. The first one is Hellblade becoming profitable in 3 months. It reached 500K sales. And for those who don't know, Hellblade is it's notable because it's a game that was started as a, how can I put it, like a new way of making quote-unquote AAA games. There's this company called Ninja Theory that was saying, we want to make AAA games, but we don't have the budget for a AAA game, but we're going to make it 20 people with a much smaller budget, and it's still going to be AAA. And so because of that, I think half factual observation, half marketing messaging, it's being presented as an alternative to AAA development by a lot of gamers in the industry. And I do think that's a little bit disingenuous. I mean, I haven't played it yet, I will, but it seems to me from what I've seen that it's not really a AAA. I mean, it has great, when it first started a couple of years ago, it was a little bit more truthful than it is today. But today we have a lot of those mid-range games that are very well developed, very well designed. You have kick-ass graphics, but the scope is still the scope of a AA game. And it seems like this one fits in that category more. But so it's become profitable, which is great. It just became profitable after 3 months. But I also know that you've been a little bit, I don't want to say critical, but you've been adding some nuance to that narrative of Hellblade as a AAA success on Twitter. And I'm curious to hear more. What's your take on that game and its model and the way it's sold?
Yeah, I mean, the game itself is really incredible in terms of what they've been able to pull off. You know, you look at the game, I guess, you know, from the graphical point of view, and it is up there with some of the top, you know, AAA games. You look at it from animations, and those are really impressive as well. You look at the gameplay, and again, that's got a lot of good elements there as well. I agree with you on the scope in terms of it's a really impressive game, but the amount of content is more similar to what you know you get out of a single player linear narrative story game, instead of maybe a open world, or not that every game needs to be open world, but you know it's not on the scale or scope of some of the bigger and larger AAA titles that we see today. But it's certainly, you know, I'd class it as indie AAA, so it is sort of bridging a sort of a gap. But I think my criticisms on Twitter is that a lot of people are looking at what Hellblade has done and then applying that to companies like EA or Ubisoft, Activision, or Take-Two, and saying, well, why can't they do it? And I think that's a bit of a stretch in terms of you know, comparing the two so closely like that. You know, with Ninja Theory here, they've got a team of 20 people, working on the game. So first of all, the costs on that are fairly low. They've also got a number of side projects that they're working on at the same time, which helps fund the game, and they've got the funding for that. At the same time as well, you know, the game still costs around $10 million to actually make, based on the 500k break-even point. So it's still a very expensive game, and that's not something that every company can, you know, do, especially indie, and especially without the prior experience or proprietary tools that Ninja Theory have. And so I think that what they've done is really exceptional, but their case study only applies to a few certain companies, mostly indies who are, you know, quite large, have a good number of employees. And secondly, those who are working on external projects or other projects and have the funding to spend, you know, $10 million or so on the game. Mm. So, you know, not to downplay what they've done, but at the end of the day, they still need to sell 500k to break even, and they've only just done that. So yes, they're profitable, but they're not making the sort of profit that a AAA would from, you know, unit sales or whatever. And the fact that it's taken them some time to get the 500k does show that, you know, it's not as clear cut as being a success as I think a lot of people think it is.
Mm. Go ahead.
When you have a AAA game where you're spending $40-50 million into that, I think a lot of people don't realize, for example, with Tomb Raider 2013, you know, there was that whole hubbub about, okay, it didn't meet expectations, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't profitable like Hellblade was. It just means that it didn't actually sell over the amount it needed to generate the amount of profit that they wanted from that. And so I think Hellblade is sort of a similar situation where, yes, it's profitable, but it hasn't sold over that amount significantly, or will sell over that significantly, to make this something that's viable without that external development support in terms of external projects and without having funding already there.
They're saying they're ahead of their projected sales. What Ninja's theory is saying is, well, we were expecting to break even in 6 months, and we're now breaking even in 3 months. So, I mean, this is, my understanding is, it's good for them, but I think the expectations of a big, huge developer like EA or Ubisoft or Activision are a little bit different. The comparison I often give is, let's say, you know, different people will have different methods of operating or of, you know, working. And if you're an artist and we say, well, we'll give you $100 to draw this thing for me for my website, maybe you'll be interested. But maybe if you're a sales guy and you make, I don't know, $5K a month, and someone tells you, well, I'll give you $100 to work for me for one day, you know, or a week, maybe you're going to say, I'm sorry, you know, I don't have time. $100 doesn't really interest me. So I think those applying the same values for everyone and for every game developer in the industry is kind of misguided. And what's great for Ninja Theory isn't necessarily great for Ubisoft, and vice versa. I mean, the kind of games that Ubisoft makes might not interest Ninja Theory. They might think, well, yeah, that's great, and you're going to make $15 billion out of this, but that's not the kind of game I want to make. So yeah, basically coming back to your point that some people are taking this to say, well, every game could be made like this. That's not like, I don't think that's a healthy way of looking at things. If you see one thing that works or doesn't, and you say, we should make all of it like this because that's what I think is valuable, I don't want to say it's dangerous, but it is not great. Yeah.
You've got to remember as well that, you know, these AAA companies are aiming for the top of the market and for, you know, the most sales and the most market share. And so I think people forget the kind of the mid-tier decline between last gen and this gen. You know, where companies like THQ went out of business, and the fact is they were producing multiple games on, you know, kind of medium budgets, but they weren't selling very well. And so in the end, they just didn't have the cash to make any more. And so, you know, especially if one game bombs, like with THQ, that can spell the end of the company. So it's still very risky for them, and it's not something that can be applied across the industry. And at the end of the day, you've got companies like Ubisoft, for example, who do still have small teams working on games. whether that's stuff like Grow Up or Atomica, which is their PC shooter, which came out, you know, that was made by 15 people, I think. And at the end of the day, you look at those games and you realize that actually the scope of those games isn't very big. The budget in those games isn't very big. And ultimately, the sales of those games isn't very big. Not every indie game is going to be Minecraft, you know, just because it's indie or whatever, or has AAA values or AAA production values. Usually, the more you spend on the game, whether it's in marketing or in development, means you get a bigger scope, better reach, more sales, more revenue, more, you know, whatever, more profit. And so doing it on a much smaller scale, like with Hellblade, for example, you can see already it's not selling multi-millions like AAA companies would expect out of their games. It's only selling 500K. It'll probably get 2 million, and it'll probably do, you know, well for what it is, but it's not something that can be replicated across every company. There are certain companies I can think of that would actually probably benefit from something like that and could actually do well, but that's a handful.
Yeah. And I mean, there is a very healthy indie market that didn't exist that way a few years ago, and that can be stretched into possibly for some of the companies, or that maybe they're not quite indie anymore, but there are a few companies that could be in that range of types of production, or that could move into that. And certainly Ninja Theory is encouraging everyone to do it and sharing the knowledge of how they managed to do it. So I hope
That aspect is great. The fact they've been so open about it, the fact that they've said that this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it, this is what works, this isn't what works. That's a huge resource for the industry and for you know, gamers in general. And just being able to understand that and kind of look at what they're doing and seeing, actually, you know what, it does work in some cases. That's great, because that means that companies that can scale up to that can follow a sort of similar pattern or similar kind of development process and hopefully be successful there. But at the same time, like I said, you know, there are thousands of indie games that release every month or, you know, every year, and the majority of them don't sell to the level of AAA games. And that's why this sort of stuff, just, you can't blanket statement and say, well, okay, well, if 20 people can make this game, why can't Activision make a game with 10 times less the budget and sell just as much as they were before? I mean, one example I like to use a lot is Resident Evil 7. With Resident Evil 7, they reduced the budget, they reduced the scope, they reduced the marketing on it, and it actually underperformed compared to what Capcom were expecting.
Oh, really? I thought Resident Evil 7 was a great success.
It did well, but it underperformed what they were expecting. Doesn't mean it didn't do well, but the fact that they expected to do sort of similar to Resident Evil 6, or actually they expected to do a bit less than that, but it actually did a bit worse than what they were expecting out of the gate. Not to say it won't sell well in the future with all the DLC and whatever, but, you know, there is a reason why it didn't sell as much, and that's because they stripped out the multiplayer, they reduced the scope, they made it first person, they took a lot of risks with it, and they changed the game up a lot, and they reduced the scope and the budget, and all of that contributed to actually selling less instead of more.
All right, let's move on to PUBG. And so it's already available in China, but it's going to change because of regulations to align with socialist values, which I'm very curious about. I know there are a few other games that were changed in the same way, with, like, there were banners for the Communist Party in game and, like, fighting for truth and communism and, like, these kinds of setups. There's also Tencent developing a new Battle Royale game called Europa, which I'm guessing they're going to bring out to the West at some point, but it's pretty good looking. And also the fact that Tencent it just crossed the $500 billion valuation, and there are only very few companies that are that valuable in the world, most of them being, you know, the Googles and Apples of the world. But yeah, first, that PUBG aligning with socialist core values, what does that even mean?
So it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, and the fact that China's government is very involved when it comes to regulating, you know, all sectors of entertainment. So in this case, video games. And so what they'll do is put out regulations in order to encourage, you know, healthy development of games. So that's why games, for example, like Grand Theft Auto, would not be officially approved for release in China, because they promote, you know, a lot of things like, you know, I guess gambling or prostitution or whatever, you know, that would be deemed to be
Immoral.
Unhealthy. Yeah, immoral, unhealthy, illegal, or whatever, compared to China's laws. And so a lot of games do have to sort of skirt that line. And you'll find that when a company wants to bring a game to China, there's a lot that they have to do compared to any other country. You know, first of all, because of localization and different language. Second, because of regulations. Third, because how the market is completely different and the business models that they have to employ. So there's a lot that needs to go into consideration when it comes to bringing games to China. And so one of these is the fact that there are regulations around what is acceptable in games and what isn't. And so that's why, just to give a random example here, with Counter-Strike Global Offensive, when that came to China, they had to remove the blood color from the game. So instead of red blood, it was black or green. Can't remember exactly which one.
That seems like also stuff we've seen before in, like, in Germany, for example. The blood was often... Yeah. So or even in Mortal Kombat on Super Nintendo, I think the blood was replaced with sweat or stuff like that. So that seems tame.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see stuff like that. And you'll see, you know, perhaps certain imagery that's removed because it seemed offensive. Or certain elements that promote, you know, gambling that's removed or whatever. Mm. And so in this case, you know, the CADPA, which is the China kind of audiovisual department, decided that, you know, they want to promote healthy usage of battle royale genre games. And so in doing that, they wanted to make it so that, you know, it goes with the correct values that China has. It's not unhealthy towards gamers who are under 18. And so that it, you know, fits in with all the other content laws or whatever. And so you'll notice that some of the games in China, rather than being battle royale games, they're more survival games, or they're more sort of military training games. So you don't... Oh,
so you put it in a context of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
So they'll change the game up slightly to make it different. So it's not a, you know, fight to the death. It's a military training exercise on an island. And, you know, when you're shot, you're not actually dead. You're just out of the game. Mm. Stuff like that. So you'll notice those small changes. And at the end of the day, the game is still the same in terms of the gameplay or whatever, but certain elements are removed, certain elements have changed. And that just allows it to have a release there a lot quicker and a lot easier. You find that a lot of it is actually self-censorship as well. So the rules are vague enough to, you know, where companies will self-censor and actually remove stuff that maybe wouldn't need to be removed, just so that they can get a release there a lot quicker and, you know, get that ball rolling.
Right. I see. Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess it would work just as well as a military exercise or something like that. But it's, if you want to, yeah, anyway, there's lots of stuff to discuss there. But we're running late, so I think we're going to bring this to a close fairly soon, unless you want to add stuff to the Europa Battle Royale game or Tencent in general.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Battle Royale genre has completely blown up. Thanks to PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, but also before that, H1Z1, you know, King of the Kill. And I think that a lot of companies, both in China and the West, are going to jump on this trend. We've already seen it with, you know, Epic Games and Fortnite. We've seen it with Rockstar Games with Grand Theft Auto and their sort of mode in there. You know, and in China, Tencent and NetEase are getting in on the trend. So I don't think this is something that's going away anytime soon. And I think it'll be interesting to see if any games can, you know, do as well as PUBG or even, you know, perform as well or send as well. And I think that'll be something that's really interesting to watch.
And Tencent is a huge company in China. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but mainly based on the fact that you need a license to operate in China, and Tencent and NetEase, but Tencent is one of the big dogs there. So many of the Western developers, if they want to operate in China and get all of that precious Chinese money, they have to go through one of those. But do you think we're going to see Tencent getting big? Is that the next step, basically? Are we going to see games published by Tencent in the West as well? Maybe brought from China, or some people have tried and it's not always successful. But That game, Europa, for example, seemed like it could be successful, but or maybe there are others, but they're getting to a size where it would be completely reasonable for them to try and get a bite of the Western market too. Do you think that's something that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, Tencent is huge in China, so they already have a number of self-developed games that they put out there themselves. In addition to that, as you say, yes, they work with partners, Western companies, to localize games there. In addition to that, they also invest in various companies such as Supercell, Epic Games, etc., and you know, reap the rewards from that.
So that's going to be their strategy for the West, is to invest in existing actors, which they've already started doing. But
yeah, I mean, that's one of the ways that they're doing it. They also work with a number of partners, for example, Garena in Southeast Asia, and distributing games there. You know, Tencent completely dominates China when it comes to games. And I think we're going to start to see them look to the West, but it might not be as direct as people think. So yes, it'll be through investments, it'll be through you know, partners and publishing games through them. And then at the same time, we'll also see Tencent, you know, try and bring their own games over, see how they do. I think there's a huge difference in the types of games that appeal to China and the games that appeal to the West. And so I think it'll be up to Tencent to sort of, you know, play around those games and perhaps create custom versions or you know, different versions that do well in the West.
Right. All right. I think that's going to be it for us. We could have talked about GT Sport adding a career mode by the end of the year, which is cool. Animal Crossing Pocket Camp came out, had server errors. Hopefully they're resolved now, but that's a thing as well. Sonic Forces, which is a poor game, is still gaining, how can I put it, like the community's favor by including the Sonic Hedgehog meme, which is really fun. You can go look it up if you know that. That's really silly. Hulu is working on a live-action Hitman series. Could happen. Mario movie deal might be in the works with the studio that made the Minions movies. I could see that being fun. And what else? Oh, very quickly, Gazillion, the company dismissed the Marvel Heroes team after announcing the game would be closed at the end of the year. They announced this like the day before Thanksgiving in the US, which is the best way if you want that news to go under the radar, which it did because everyone was away for Thanksgiving. That's kind of the slimy move, I think. So I wanted to mention it.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, the PR-wise, that's definitely a technique, right? That's not random.
I think they were just
sweeping it.
Doing what's best for the business, which wasn't the best thing anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we knew the game was going to close, but the team being dismissed on that specific day, like they show up and they're like, yep, you're done, go home. It's kind of crappy. Anyway, but on the other end of this, the publisher for Axiom Verge, which is an indie game, was donating 75% of its profits to the developer, which Axiom Verge is a very small indie Metroidvania that was published on many, many platforms. And the developer, Tom Happ, his son, is sick. And they didn't want to talk about it. The publisher is Badland Games. They didn't want to talk about it because they didn't want to be seen as using it as a crappy kind of promotion method. But they've been donating a lot of the profits to him so that he can take care of his son, which, there you go, there's a crappy story and a heartwarming story. So good job, Badland Games. That's mighty fine of you, and we encourage you and applaud you. All right, that's it for the show. Very lengthy and interesting show, I hope. Before we leave, Daniel, would you tell people where they can find you on the internet if they want more from you?
Sure. So I have a Twitter account, which I post on fairly regularly. I think that's probably the best place. So that's at DrewKEX. I'm sure it'll be in the notes underneath the podcast, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And then also, yeah, I mean, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm an analyst for Nico Partners. So that's my kind of NicoPartners.com to see some of the services that we offer. And then also there's a blog on there, which I run and put stuff on. I think it's quite interesting, so check it out.
Excellent. So as you mentioned, the best way to get in touch is the, or to start as a starting point, is the Twitter account, and that will be in the show notes. My Twitter account is not Patrick. You can also find me under that name on Facebook, and you will have the show notes at frenchspin.com, where you will also find the other shows I produce. I mentioned the Phileas Club, which is a really interesting, if I may say so myself, podcast about world news, where we try to be measured and get everyone's opinions in there. We recently did an episode about life as a woman, which I think went well. I was super nervous about it, but it's gotten great feedback. So if you think that's something you might be interested in learning more about and listening to what it actually is to be a woman in Western societies these days, I would encourage you to listen to that. And as I mentioned, it was very nervous for me, but I think it went well. But getting back to this show, Pixels, if you enjoy it, you might want to go on iTunes, for example, and leave a review, as Holistic Robot did. He says, the best gaming podcast I listen to. Wow, that's high praise, because there are really good podcasts out there. Seriously, Patrick brings his passion for gaming to the discussions and invites a variety of guests to share their thoughts on gaming and gaming news. I may not always agree or even understand, parentheses, fighting games, Patrick, really? But it's always fun regardless. Well, maybe Fantasy Strike is going to be the game for you. But thank you. Yes, we try to do this in the most serious / passionate way there is. And I hope you appreciate the kind of reflection, measure, thought that goes into the show. If you do, you can let us know on Twitter, or just, you know, let your friends know they should listen to this show on social media, or just in person. That's the most difficult thing with podcasts, is it's to reach new people. So if you enjoy it, tell a friend, or tell many friends, or just start playing the podcast in your working open space, and just don't let anyone turn it down so that they get invaded with the goodness of the show. Or maybe don't do that, but tell people it's fun. Regardless, thank you very much for listening. We hope you will join us again in about a couple of weeks when we come back. Until then, we send to all of you many good thoughts and hugs and kisses. Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.